Shoot the defense, the best podcast in the world. We're out here.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you played against?
Henry.
And the fact that we are now taking our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it, and send in a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Shoot the Defence. It's my top five matches. I'm your host, Stel. And my guest this week is a returning guest. He's all the way in Medellin in Colombia. He's a South American football journalist, a Colombian football expert for World Football Index, Simon Edwards. Simon, welcome back to the show, mate. How you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. Stuck inside, but getting by, and yeah, looking forward to talk about some happy times outside, enjoying football, stadiums, all sorts of stuff that we can't enjoy now, but we can look back and look forward to when we can do it again in the future.
Absolutely, and I see World Football Index is putting out content daily, which is great.
Yeah, we're trying to do a few more things. We're looking back again at some key moments and looking at some scouting stuff. So yeah, check out World Football Index for some more. Mostly South American. We had something on the Algerian side that upset the Germans at the 82 World Cup. It was yeah. So that was a fun episode. So there's some bits and pieces out there for you.
Excellent. So tell me something. I'm not going to ask you how you're coping, because by the sound of your voice, you seem very upbeat. But in terms of putting out content, obviously there's no football going on out there. You're probably doing something similar to what I'm doing in terms of getting all nostalgic and talking about old games and whatnot. But are you able to access certain players for interviews?
Yeah, I think if you have the right connection, there are definitely players who've got nothing to do and are willing to give you some content, give you their thoughts. Obviously, as well, journalists, again, perhaps journalists who'd only take paid gigs are happy to give a bit of a hand to people at this time. That's something I found. So, yeah, it's weird, but everyone's stuck inside and some people are busy, some people are not. But impression is that people have been quite generous when they can. Obviously, some players are a little bit controlled, but yeah, you know, from players on FIFA, players, you know, doing all kinds of stuff, they're trying to keep themselves entertained as well. So yeah, I've had some players very happy to give a bit of their time if they can.
Well, this is interesting, because I'm not going to mention the clubs that I've been in contact with in the UK recently, but I've tried to gain access to their players, but they just don't want to help. They're just very precious about their players. I don't know whether it's because they're comms guys and that's their jobs, and obviously they've got obligations with rights holders like your Skys, your BTs and whatnot. But when I speak to people from abroad in, say, Scandinavian countries, in, you know, Spain, in France, Germany, they're very happy to release players, which is quite bizarre.
Yeah, perhaps. I know here in Colombia, clubs are worried that they won't survive, and I'm sure there will be clubs that don't exist by the time this is over. Mm. Basically, all Colombian players are available at a 60% discount, more or less, at the moment. So it gives you an idea that I think Colombian clubs are looking to sell their players as much as they can. And again, perhaps getting the player out there, getting the player in the headlines, perhaps is a way of keeping them front of mind, and I think clubs maybe have things off the field to worry about at the moment, and maybe this is something that they're a bit more relaxed about. Who knows?
I don't know. I think it's just a weird British thing, I guess. I don't know. Right, so while we're on the subject of South America, let's talk about your top five games. So we'll begin with the first one. 5th of September 1993, Argentina 0, Colombia 5. Now, this was a World Cup qualifier. Argentina had got to the World Cup final in 1990. They lost to Germany. There's no Maradona in this team. We see the likes of a young Gabriel Batistuta, Diego Simeone. Sergio Goycochea was in goal, the penalty hero in the semi-final of the World Cup in Italy. Did you see this one coming?
No, I have to be honest, right? I didn't see this one live, but it's a game that's so important in the history of Colombia that I've seen it like 10 times since. And this is an Argentina that had never lost a competitive game at home in their history. Before the game, Maradona was saying, okay, you know, Colombia, they're doing well this qualifying campaign, but look, Colombia is here and Argentina is up here. They're not on the same level. You know, when Colombia play Argentina, Argentina win. And again, as I say, this is a Colombia team that got into this final game in a good position to qualify. I think a draw would have been enough to get them guaranteed to the World Cup. But it wasn't a draw. It was a 5-0 win for Colombia away in Argentina. And after this, before this game, Maradona said Colombia have no chance to win against Argentina. And after this game, Pelé named Colombia the favourites to win the World Cup. So it was a huge night. And to put it in a little bit of context, this is Colombia in the wake of the violence of Pablo Escobar. This is Colombia in a very complicated situation with Marxist guerrillas, with paramilitary groups. It's a very, very violent country that is in the news for all of the bad reasons. And this team gave the people of Colombia hope that they would make some headlines, that they could show a positive image to the world. So the relief and the joy that people felt after this game and going into the World Cup was huge for Colombia. And it was a kind of a high point before, again, a real sad moment with Andrés Escobar, the central defender, eventually being murdered at the World Cup. But looking at this game, it was a joy to behold, and they played some really, really great football as well.
Well, look, let's take a sidestep here, because I want to ask you about the state of Colombian football during the Escobar era, so to speak. We've seen, I'm sure everyone's seen the Netflix show about Escobar, the documentary, the Hollywoodized documentary. We know about Millonarios and all these other clubs owned by cartels, but what was the state of Colombian football?
Yeah, so, I mean, at this point in the 1980s, Colombia, in a way, dominated South American football. America de Cali got to, you know, four or five finals, Copa Libertadores finals. They lost all of them. And it was actually Atlético Nacional who won the first Colombian final in 1989. But Colombian teams had been at the very, very top. Atlético Nacional, who made up a large percentage of this 1993 team. There was a mix between Nacional and Cali and Junior in the Caribbean coast, the three teams that made most of these players from this side. But Atlético Nacional focused on Colombian players, and they were able to retain a lot of the best Colombian players. Asprilla was in there, Leonel Alvarez. They had a really strong side. And then América de Cali brought in some of the best players from around the continent. And Junior had Valderrama, they had Valenciano. Valenciano is a striker who was known as the Golden Fatty. it was a bit rotund, but he was really brilliant. So this Colombia squad had a lot of personalities. On the bench for this game, there was the Golden Fatty and the Smurf. He was a 5'4" De Avila, a really classy player from America de Cali. But in terms of the situation, yeah, of course. I mean, Colombia at this time wasn't in the hands really of the government. The government was trying its best to assert itself, but you know, everything was run by the cartels, who had the money, who had the weapons, who had the power in the country. And football was no different. You know, the league at one point was cancelled because referees were being murdered. There was incredible quality. And Maturana, the manager for this Colombia team, was also the manager of Nacional in 1989. Was a great manager, very progressive, very, very modern. Played a real total football, high defensive lines, attacking fullbacks. A very fluid front two with Freddy Rincon flying forward as well. Asprilla pressing hard from the front. Valderrama just pass and move. And then Rene Higuita coming off his line to be a very modern sweeper keeper, perhaps even more modern than today, given the fact that he would dribble upfield. And there was one point where he was appealing for a penalty. That's how far he'd got up into the opposition half in a game in the Colombian league. So Colombian football was excellent, but it came from the money, and the situation enabled Colombia to keep its best players and also attract some of the stars from around South America in the 80s and early 90s.
I remember listening to Tim Vicker in a recent podcast with you saying how important Higuita was to the Colombian national team. When Cordoba came in, it's almost as if they lost that edge, because Higuita was kind of making them tick at the back.
Yeah, and Oscar Córdoba, you know, many Colombians, perhaps those less adventurous, would say Oscar Córdoba was maybe a better goalkeeper. Now, I don't know. Higuita was excellent as well. But Córdoba wasn't just some guy they stuck in. He was playing Argentina. He was an important goalkeeper. But he wasn't Higuita. He didn't want the ball at his feet. And he was, you could see him looking very, very uncomfortable, as pretty much any goalkeeper would from the early 90s, if asked to come out of his area and try and play. So that definitely, it was a factor for Colombia. They weren't quite as good with Oscar Córdoba in goal. But on this night, Oscar Córdoba had a very good game, made some good saves. But as we got into the World Cup, Higuita was definitely a calming presence. Perhaps you look back to the 1990 World Cup and you may be surprised that the Colombian players were so trusting of him. But he definitely did have unwavering confidence and did help the team to relax and to be their best at difficult moments.
Absolutely, and they fully exploited that Argentina back line and his attacking masterclass, and Asprilla's first goal was sublime. The way that he brought the ball down, crikey, what a player he was.
Yeah, no, and that game as well, you watch the game and the way that he's pressing the defence, and he was just tireless. People maybe think of Asprilla and they think of some of the exploits off the field and maybe he's a bit of a rogue character, which he definitely was. I mean, you know, you get into his private life and he is a character. You know, he shot someone. Like, this is a guy with a bit of a backstory. But he was also on the field, especially at a young age, very, very collective, very hardworking. And yeah, that plucking the ball out of the sky and cutting inside and scoring. And then his second goal, where he's running down the left onto a through ball and he just opens his body and just drifts the ball away to the far post, clipping over the goalkeeper. It's just one of the most beautiful finishes I've ever seen. Just looks effortless. And the commentators in Colombia were just losing their minds. Like, they were demanding that tomorrow be a national holiday. You know, we've got to celebrate this. And you know, Colombia really did celebrate it. And again, in the aftermath of the game, a lot of people died in the celebrations, which is mad to think. But yeah, you know, this team went so much, and you throw all of that energy into a volatile situation, and you know, it can be a little bit dangerous. And it definitely seems that the streets were a joyous place to be after the game, but also a little bit wild, a little bit rowdy.
Absolutely, and the win meant that Colombia qualified automatically for the World Cup, and we all know what happened at USA 94. And can you dispel a bit of a myth about Andres Escobar? Because a lot of people who don't know reckon that his death was caused due to, a drug deal gone wrong. But it had nothing to do with that, did it?
No, so he was, you know, he was a family man. He was very mature. He was from a little bit more of a middle-class neighbourhood than many of the players. He was the gentleman. You know, that's what he was known as at the time. And he was the gentleman of the team, and he's been known since as the eternal number two. But yeah, he was the guy with the wife and the good background, and he was the level-headed guy. And once he got back to Medellin, the Nacional fans obviously adored him. And this is a player who was real quality. He was off to Italy before the incident. You know, he was going to have a really big career, and he'd been a very, very classy player. But yeah, back to Medellin, the Nacional fans obviously love him for his time at the club, and he felt reassured by the positive, the reassurance of the fans. And he went out for a drink with some friends, got into an argument, got some grief from some people in the bar. Eventually, was shot by the bodyguard of some mafia guys. You know, the bodyguard took the entire rap. You know, there's no way a bodyguard is shooting someone without the permission of the guys he's standing next to, getting a bit of an argument. So, yeah, I mean, he was the victim of Colombia in a very volatile situation. There's talk of money being lost for gambling, and maybe that was true, but just getting into an argument and things boiling over in the car park does seem enough at that time to result in a very unfortunate, very sad death.
Doesn't seem that the country has quite recovered from that, to be fair.
Well, I mean, you know, if you go to watch Atletico Nacional today, the number 2 1989 Andres Escobar shirt is still very important, and there's still banners in the crowd. Colombia today is much, much safer. Colombia is still the biggest cocaine producer in the world, more so now than the time of Escobar. But the situation is that side of that business isn't necessarily as associated with violence and gangs. It's more professional, so people are able to completely ignore it. Colombia is an amazing place. I couldn't imagine living anywhere else. And these things don't have any impacts on your day-to-day experience. I would recommend everybody come visit Colombia when you can step outside your house. But of course, in a country where there's a billion-dollar product available and a great deal of poverty, there's always going to be situations. And yeah, Colombia is not completely changed, but the situation is a thousand times better than it was at this time. And fortunately, we haven't seen this kind of issue as Pablo Andrés Escobar faced in recent years.
Mm, fantastic. Okay, next game, closer to home. Euro 96, England 4, the Netherlands 1. I remember this game, I was with my parents at the time, I was 15. Euro 96 was obviously a massive deal for us out here. People were wearing the hats, they had the banners. Badil and Skinner became even more famous and even richer, and they're still living off those royalties now. But if we want to talk about the game, well, both teams only needed a draw to go through. England had drawn with Switzerland in their opening game, but then they beat Scotland 2-0 thanks to a fantastic Paul Gascoigne goal, whereas the Dutch drew with Scotland but beat Switzerland 2-0. What happened? Well, England absolutely pommeled them, really. Terry Venables' team were just absolutely phenomenal. Shearer gave England the lead, and then within 12 minutes, England absolutely pommeled them, as I said. So why this game, mate?
Yeah, I mean, Euro 96 was the first international tournament that really, really got me. Obviously, 94, I was aware, I saw bits and pieces, but by 96, I was, 10, 11 years old. And,
oh, you're making me feel old now, man.
But yeah, every day in the garden with my brother playing, playing one touch, getting the ball up in the air, you've got to try and score, and, calling out the players' names. My grandma thought I was mad because I knew the name of all of the Romanian players. Radichal, Pepescu, all of these guys. Uh-huh. But this was the tournament where I was so into football, and I drew pictures of all of the players, like cartoons, all of the little stands, the little big-headed guys, drew all of those on a bit of paper, and I wrote out all of the scores and my predictions and the teams. And yeah, this was when football was the most important thing. And this was a tournament. It was in England. Everyone was happy. The weather seemed to be perfect for 3 weeks, 4 weeks. So it was an amazing time, and this was the perfect game. The England had struggled in the opener. They just got past Scotland, 2-0, but Scotland had missed a penalty, and everyone wanted to be a goalkeeper back then as well. I just remember that summer with David Seaman saving penalties, suddenly the volunteers to go in goal were through the roof. Uh-huh. It was just an amazing summer, and this was just the perfect game on a perfect sunny day. Ready, Teddy, Sherry, ready for a cup of sherry or something. I'm in the commentary. just a perfect game. And that Shearer goal, the second one, where it's pulled back, Sheringham shapes a shoot and squares it to Shearer, who kind of strikes it, but it pulls away into the top corner. And it was just a beautiful goal. So, yeah, just basically this game was like the perfect moment in a perfect childhood summer for me.
And the thing is, this Dutch side, I was talking to Ramon Vega about it. This Dutch side, most of them had won the Champions League with Ajax that season.
Yeah, it's strong. You look across the team, Bergkamp, Blind, De Boer, Seedorf, Witschke, Philip Cocu come off the bench. I was a little bit surprised by the way they laid out. I mean, Jordi Cruyff getting a start was a little bit of a surprise. But the quality they had is obviously clear. And you look on paper, they look like a match for England. And obviously going into the game, there was a lot of nerves. Okay, we've done okay, but now we're facing Holland. This is going to be by far our toughest game. And the fact that everything just went perfectly, and that, after halftime, that 10 minutes after halftime, scoring two goals, and then, okay, there's no stress. Some of the games I've chosen have been runaway victories. Maybe I can't deal with the stress, but this was just, after 50 minutes, it's just a party, and then you can just enjoy the game, and everything's going right. And then Clivert scored and eliminated Scotland at the end as well, which I wasn't happy about, but some people seem to enjoy.
Brilliant. Right, next game. Wow. Not good memories for me as a Man United fan, but Arsenal beating Everton 4-0 at Highbury. In fact, I think Arsenal wrapped up the title with two games to go. Overmars gave Arsenal the lead. In fact, he scored twice either side of half-time. We know about Tony Adams' famous goal at the end where he's kind of burst through and just like a striker, he's just fired it past the keeper. And the interesting thing about this one, which I only found out when I was doing a bit of research on the scenario, because I remember the game, but I didn't know that when Arsenal won at Anfield on the last day of the season, 88-89, their back four was Bold, Dixon, Adams and Winterburn. Now, I think with about 10 or 15 minutes to go, Steve Bold came on in this particular game and they had exactly the same back four as they did in 88-89 when they won the league. It was incredible. So, yeah, why this game for you, mate?
Yeah, so, all right, this is a bit weird. Okay, so basically, right, for this game, I was 11. 96, I was actually like 9, but for this game, I was like 11 years old. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest, right, when I was 7, 8 years old, I really liked Ryan Giggs and I kind of became a little bit of a Man United fan. And you know what? You know what kit I got for my 7th, 8th birthday? Guess which Man United kit, kind of mid to late 90s, would be the worst possible.
The invisible kit.
Yeah.
The grey kit.
I had the socks, shorts, shirt with number 11 Ryan Giggs on the back, and they wore it for 45 minutes. So I couldn't get my money back, but you know, I love the way Ryan Giggs dribbled on his toes, his run on his toes. I loved him, but. You know, I lived in London. Yeah, it didn't really make any sense to me to be a Man United fan. And my dad actually supports Tottenham, so maybe I've just been winding him up or something. I don't know. But basically, by 96, 97, I was starting to become more of an Arsenal fan. My friend was playing for Arsenal. I'd been to Arsenal quite a lot. And I was by this season, I was kind of on the verge of becoming a full-on Arsenal fan. And this season, this team kind of helped me, push me over the edge, basically, or made me realise that I was enjoying this team more than I was enjoying Man United, and I really was an Arsenal fan. So this might be blasphemy for some people, but I'm just talking about my personal process, right? And yeah, this team was great. Patrick Vieira, Emmanuel Petit in the middle, Mark Overmars on the wing, and then that back four was just a great team. This game, they actually had Christopher Ray up front, which, yep. No, I remember I was watching it back this week and they're going, Christopher Ray is the star for the future. He's going to be the next big thing. And it didn't quite happen. But but just the quality of this team, Patrick Vieira and Emmanuel Petit in particular, I was a huge, huge fan of.
Well, you know, it's funny how they talk about managers needing time to build a squad that's good enough to challenge for honours. And Jurgen Klopp had a few years before making Liverpool a real force. Wenger was only at Arsenal for what, half a season before, you know, he had his first proper pre-season. I think Vieira had joined when Wenger had first signed for Arsenal. So it's not as if did Vieira actually play that for the half the season Wenger? I can't remember, but I don't think he was signed that summer. I'm pretty sure he was signed prior to the summer. But that summer they brought in Overmars, they brought in Petit. And again, no one really knew what to expect from Arsenal because this new guy's coming. No one knew who Wenger was anyway. He was from Japan, for crying out loud. He came from Grand Passate, I think. And again, no one knew who he was. I think only Glenn Hoddle knew who Arsene Wenger was because he coached him at Monaco. So yeah, he's coming with this, I don't know, basic reputation according to the Brits. But he turned English football around completely and the style of football that they played. I'm not going to lie to you, mate. I think this Arsenal team, for me, this 97-98 Arsenal team, was far more threatening than the Invincibles team. And people are going to be listening saying, oh, you're talking rubbish or whatever. But when you look at how direct they were with Overmars, with players like Boamorte, Petit and Vieira in the middle of the park, they weren't like Gilberto and Vieira in the sense that they were physical, but very, very technical. Petit had that tactical sense around him as well. Yeah, and they were absolutely explosive with Anelka as well. Christ.
Yeah, Anelka and then Ian Wright, Dennis Bergkamp. Yeah, it was a great team. And Emmanuel Petit was a great player. You know, watching back the games, just the way, because obviously, you know, you think of him later in his career when he was very sensible, very balanced, but the energy he had when he first arrived at Arsenal as well. And obviously Patrick Vieira driving forward. Ray Parlour as well. Again, you think of Ray Parlour a couple of years after that, maybe lost a bit of the pace, but he had a bit of pace about him, was quite direct as well. And Mark Overmars was just the fastest player I've ever seen. But all of that exciting stuff built upon a very, very well-drilled Dixon, Adams, Keown, Winterburn. Steve Bold as well played an important role in his final season here at Arsenal. Even guys like David Platt still in the squad off the bench. So it was a great team, and obviously it was the start of a lot of good things to come the years that followed. So, you know, I kind of felt that maybe becoming an Arsenal fan, maybe I'd see a bit less glory, a little bit less less exciting football. But, you know, maybe I was ready to sacrifice that. And then the team that Arsene Wenger built turned out to be just as good, even perhaps slightly better in the coming years than the Man United team I'd admired initially.
Brilliant. Just for the record, Vieira signed for Arsenal in August 96. So there you go. So he wasn't signed in 97 in the summer. So there you go. I feel a little bit better now, because I thought, oh, 1 minute I'm going to be listening back to it saying, shit, I got this one completely wrong. But no, I was right. He did sign prior to 97, 98. Mm. Anyway, great stuff. Right, so next game. Colombia 2, Uruguay 0. A certain James Rodriguez, who I remember very well at Porto, and I was saying for years that this kid is going to be something special, when that World Cup was his World Cup, wasn't it? A fantastic volley, which I don't think anyone will ever forget. And the second goal weren't too bad either. So I presume you were living in Colombia at the time. So this is one of the games that's up there for you?
Yeah. I was in Parque Lleras. I was in Poblado. So I was actually in a bar. And, you know, one of the things that slightly ruined the game is I was in the bar that had the TV feed 4 seconds behind every other bar in the neighborhood. So I heard this goal a few seconds before I saw it, which is honestly, I still pick this game because I love this game, but Jesus Christ, that was hard. You go, oh my God, there's a chance. Everyone goes, oh, and you go, well, that's ruined it then. So, but it was wild. Just every, you know, when Colombia play, every single person wears a yellow shirt. Mm. Now, they're not all real Colombia shirts. You can get a fake one.
Of course.
AAA replica. You can get all kinds of fakes. But every single person was wearing a yellow shirt. They were spraying like foam all over the place, all in the sky. Literally, every single part of the street was filled with people. People watching it in the big screen outside. People in all the bars. And it was just a... This is the first time Colombia were back at the World Cup. And, you know, they had the 1990 team, which was great. The 94 team was great. And then the 1998 was an aging form of those sides. And since then, you know, they had Ivan Cordoba, who was a great player, Juan Pablo Angel, but very, very little. A huge, huge drop-off in terms of the quality of the national side. They won the Copa America in 2001, but that was that generation on its out. And then back at the World Cup finally, and doing Colombia proud. So it was an amazing time to be here.
Absolutely. And this game was Falcao-less, wasn't it? Radamel didn't start. In fact, he didn't play at all.
Yeah, he'd been injured. So, I mean, Colombia actually at the time had an incredible selection of strikers. They had some of the top strikers across all of Europe. Jackson Martinez, Carlos Bacca, Adrian Ramos. These are, you know, the top scorers in each of their respective leagues. Teofilo Gutierrez was a good player as well. But yeah, that was obviously the big issue going into this tournament. You know, who to play up front. It turned out that you didn't really need a striker when you had James Rodriguez in this form, and he was the best player in that tournament. You know, Messi was named player of the tournament, but I think most fair observers, and I love Messi, of course, would say that this was James Rodriguez's tournament, and he was great. He was so good, and it was a team that played with such joy. You know, obviously the celebrations, it was a representation of Colombia, which was so important. You know, I talk back to 94, and people hoped that would be the chance for Colombia to show the world what they're about, and I think 2014 really did that as well. Just the way that they played with such energy, Cuadrado, and the flair, and then they would score a goal and they would celebrate with a bit of salsa in the corner. And I think it was a real embodiment of this team, because, you know, growing up in England, you know, I loved the 96 team, 98, but by the 2000s, it was a bit drab. It was very, the pressure was through the roof on the players, and you could see the players didn't really enjoy a lot of the things that came with playing for England. But this Colombia team just couldn't believe their luck to be at a World Cup representing Colombia. They just adored every second of it, and you could see it on their faces. You could see it by the way they played and the way they celebrated. So they were just such good representatives of this country. Mix of races, mix of backgrounds, mix of cultures. But it all came together in the way they played and the dancing and the energy. So, yeah, I just think this was a great win from a great side that really did Colombia proud.
Why do you think Colombia have never got to a World Cup final? I know it's a difficult question to answer because when you mentioned the great teams in the past, and I think the closest they got was the recent World Cup where they lost to England on penalties. And even that was a pretty decent team as well, to be fair.
Yeah, well, I think before, the thing is, Colombia had its golden age in like the 50s when it was a pirate league, when they were... Basically, they were not members of FIFA, so they just would go over to Brazil and give someone a suitcase full of money and then drag them off on a plane without getting them to sign a contract, right? So, and including English players, including World Cup win, anyone. You get a Colombian knocker, give you a tap on the shoulder and hand you a load of money and off you go to Colombia to play. So that was a great time for Colombia. Then after that, there was nothing. And then the great team of 1994, I think 94 was the best team Colombia had before the recent generation, right? But the situation in the country meant they couldn't live up to their potential. It was madness, right? And in the 20 years after, I mean, you look at the Colombia team of 2007, 2008, they were bad. Like, the best player on the team was, like, Rodallega. What did Colombian thought Rodallega was going to be better than Messi?
Oh, come on.
He was the top goal scorer at a youth tournament, and he played amazingly well, and he was like the big hope. Rodallega is going to be the next Messi. So Colombia were clutching at straws in the mid-2000s, and most of the players didn't move abroad. You know, there's been a real step up. Colombia had massively underachieved because Colombia is the second highest country in South America by population. It has many big cities. It's football mad. There's a range of cultures, a range of ethnicities. There's all kinds of stuff in the mix that should mean Colombia is one of the best in the world. And I think they're getting there. I think there's stuff they need to improve in coaching and certain aspects. But the raw materials now are, I would say, in terms of raw talent and raw materials, they're above Argentina. But they don't have the culture. They don't have the history. They don't have the ideas that some of the other South American countries, more established ones, have. So I think Colombia is getting there, but I think for a long time they underachieved. And again, 2018, that England game is depressing for me because Colombia came out to defend. The game was horrible, right? England were horrible, Colombia were horrible. It was a mess. It was a fight. It was disgusting, right? But I can't complain about any of the injustice against Colombia, you know, because Colombians feel that. But I can't complain because they played three defensive midfielders against Dele Alli and Jesse Lingard. Like, you don't deserve to win. You can't, like, Jesus Christ. There's not a creative bone in their body. Like, don't worry about them. Worry about them whipping the ball into the box. But anyway.
Oh blimey. I completely agree with you on that one, mate. one more thing, mate. James Rodriguez. A player had so much potential, right? And I know he's won a shit ton of honours, you know, Champions Leagues, Bundesliga, La Liga, etc., etc. But do you think one day he will look back on his career and say, perhaps I shouldn't have gone to this club or that club or made that decision? Because it just seems to me that he's a wasted talent.
Yeah, I think on the way up, he kind of did everything right. He went off to Argentina, he went to Porto, Monaco, you know, and then got the big move to Real Madrid. Now, again, he was one of the best players, if not the best player at a World Cup. You go to Real Madrid, you try your luck. But, yeah, you know, I think moving a slight step down from Real Madrid slightly earlier would have given him the chance, because he's a player who has to be the main man to really be his best. And look, he's done well for Real Madrid. He's done pretty well for Bayern Munich. He's been a useful player for them. But I think to get the best out of James, he has to be the main man. And for Colombia, he is the main man. And more often than not, that's a positive thing. At times, he doesn't necessarily trust those around him to kind of take chances or maybe play the awkward passes. He wants to do it himself. But I think if he goes to a team half a run down, if he goes to, you know, links with Everton, I'd love to see him at Everton. Because I think if he's in the Sigurdsson role, right, and he's got more energy, he's got more individual, can beat a man a little bit more than someone like Sigurdsson, he could really become that superstar and then move back up to the very top tier. I think once his minutes had diminished at Real Madrid, I think it would have made maybe some sense to take a step back and then go forward again. So perhaps there's some regret there, but you know, he's lived an amazing lifestyle and he's now got a lot of options for the for his next move. Talk of the United States, which perhaps is a bit premature for me, but you know, he's had a decent career. He's had a nice life. He's made quite a lot of money. So, you know, people can sometimes forget that for a Colombian player, money is important. You know, Jackson Martinez went off to China and people laugh at him. You know, why would you go to China? You know, one of the best strikers in Europe and you ruin your career and go to China. But he's set up a charity that's supported over 100,000 children, like off the back of that move to China. So when his career is over, he's scored a lot of goals, he's played at the top level, but maybe his biggest achievement will be the support he's given. You look at Jerry Mina, the charity he's set up, he's basically built a school and he runs the school with his family. So, you know, I think we can sometimes forget that these are people living in poverty. Cuadrado almost didn't become a footballer because he was malnourished, because his mother was making huge sacrifices to get him to go and play football. And clubs looked at him and said, you know, you're too skinny. So, you know, these are humans as well. So, again, get a bit deep here and, you know, whatever. But I think it is important as well to think that these are people from neighbourhoods where just surviving to 40 years old is a tough thing to do. And now they're helping hundreds of thousands of people across the country to achieve things they wouldn't usually be able to achieve. I mean, Jackson Martinez's great, great, great granddaughter is going to go to university. And that wouldn't have happened if he didn't play football. So it's interesting to think about those types of things as well.
Of course, perspective, mate. Right, our final game. Atletico Nacional 3, Rosario Central 1. Copa Libertadores 2016. I've watched the highlights of this. Rosario Central went a goal up. I think they were 1-0 up from the first leg, if I'm correct.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
And
so,
then
yeah.
Atletico Nacional pulled one back on the stroke of half-time. Then they made it 2-2. And then in the 95th minute, they made it 3-2. And then carnage ensued. What's going on here?
Yeah. So this was the only game that was remotely difficult for Nacional, the only tie that Nacional found difficult in this Libertadores campaign. They won the 2016 Copa Libertadores in the most dominant fashion of any team in the history of South American football. They drew one game 0-0 in the group stage, and then they won every game convincingly apart from that. They beat Sao Paulo 2-0 and 2-1, so scored four goals over two games against Sao Paulo. They fairly comfortably won the final against an Ecuadorian side, Independiente del Valle. So they'd been excellent. They'd been incredible. And this Rosario game, again, as we say, they lost away. And then Rosario scored an away goal in Colombia. And it meant that Colombia would have to win 3-1. And that's what they did. The Rosario were sitting back and defending and trying to defend the lead. And they were trying to wind up the Nacional players. And you see, you know, the time wasting in South America is a thing of beauty if you're supporting the Bolivian underdogs against the Brazilians. But when you're a victim of it, it's incredibly infuriating. And the goalkeeper had been winding up all the Nacional players and he'd gone to take a goal kick. And then, oh, sorry, I forgot. I'm going to go get a drink of water and, you know, I'll clean my boots. And just the tension is building and building and building. And then finally, Ibarguin runs down, beats three or four players, hangs a cross up. The captain, Alexis Enriquez, knocks it down. And Orlando Berrio volleys it in and straight into the goalkeeper's face, screaming in his face, going, ah, how do you like that? How do you like that? Off into the crowd. The crowd all piling onto the pitch. The dugout is all on the pitch. I was in the stadium and you know, that roar was something that you just couldn't believe. 45,000 fans. Who'd been just singing and bouncing and jumping all game, and then suddenly just an explosion. Now, when you think it's not going to happen, when you think the moment's gone, and then it happens. And it was a team that was the best on the continent. They won the Libertadores. By the end of the year, they were in the final of the Sudamericana, which was the equivalent to the Europa League, and they were top favourites to win that. They were playing against Chapecoense. When the air disaster happened, Nacional awarded the title in memory of the Chapecoense players who died in the air crash. So that Nacional team was incredible for what it did on the pitch. Davinson Sanchez is a name you might know. Also, Marlos Moreno, who was brilliant. you know, the one who went to Manchester City, the teenager who went to Manchester City for a load of money and then completely saw his career come to a stop. But he was a brilliant, brilliant player. And yeah, just the quality of that Nacional side. Almost every player in that team went on to represent Colombia or Venezuela, as Alejandro Guerrero in midfield. But it was such a good team. And this was almost the end of the journey. And it wasn't. And it was the only game which was complicated for Nacional. And I think maybe the win was even sweeter. The winning the Libertadores, it would have been great to have won it and just made it easy the whole way through. Every game you win, simply. But to have this one game where 95th minute winner. And actually in the 111th minute, Lo Celso got sent off for a clothesline as well. So that gives you a sense of what kind of game it was.
Well, when you sent me that clip, I was like, is that him? It was him. So he's got a bit of a snidey side to him. But yeah, when I was watching the highlights of the game, and then when the winning goal went, I'm thinking, why has it all kicked off? And then it makes sense, because I didn't notice him having a go at the keeper, because the camera had panned directly straight to him, so the goalkeeper was still on the ground. It did go off, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, South American, if you're eliminated in South American football and you don't go out with three red cards and a fight, then you're not really trying, to be honest. The Uruguayans in particular are famous for that. You know, if Nacional are on their way out, then, you know, and you're winning 3-0, you don't want to piss about. Like, you don't want to mock the rivals, because they will break your legs and they will you know, happily take the red card. And, you know, it's, you know, representing some of the fury in the fans. But yeah, so just an amazing memory. And they went on to play the World Club Cup and they lost to a Japanese side. And again, I think a lot of the stress and the difficulties of dealing with this real tragedy, and also just the way that the city of Medellin responded to the Chapecoense air disaster. There was a huge ceremony in the stadium and it was completely packed. And yeah, it created a bond between those two clubs and the populations of Brazil and Colombia. And they'd basically done everything right, but got to the World Club Cup and couldn't have an impression there. They actually were the first team to be robbed by VAR. So,
oh, wow.
That's also they were, yeah, it was, I can't remember the details, but basically they were denied a goal and then the other team scored immediately. And VAR. But hey, it was, an amazing team and a team that I will remember for the rest of my life, that 2016 Nacional side.
Absolutely. Well, look, while you mentioned the World Club Cup, it seems that the South American teams take it far more serious than the European champions. But this year, or this season, shall I say, Liverpool won it. They beat Flamengo in the final. Because I was talking to Roberto Rojas about the Boca Juniors game at the Bernabeu between Boca and River Plate, and how, you know, both teams really wanted it, but unfortunately, because of the problems off the field, they had to relocate it to Spain. And then we discussed the possibility of Copa Libertadores games being hosted in Europe. Can you see that happening in the future?
I think what's more likely in terms of just the Libertadores is that they might try to play more games at the weekend at more convenient timings. I think the one of final, because traditionally the Libertadores final has been played on Wednesday nights, two games on, you know, consecutive Wednesdays, and they moved it to earlier on the weekend, and they got some good viewing numbers in Europe for that. So I suspect that more likely is that they'll try to get domestic leagues to play during the week, and then try to get Libertadores at the weekend, perhaps earlier kickoffs. Might be something they look to do. I also think, you know, I think with the Club World Cup expanding, and looking to include more teams and make it a proper tournament, I think that's something that the South Americans are very keen to do as well, because the Club World Cup is huge for South American teams. It's the only chance they get to play European teams in a competitive game. So, you know, even when Nacional won the Libertadores in 2016, Orlando Borrio had a headdress with a kamikaze logo, which is perhaps culturally insensitive, but
bloody hell,
I'm not sure. But again, it's because we're off to Japan. We're, you know, this is a celebration. You know, that was as big as winning the Libertadores, is the chance to potentially play a Real Madrid in a competitive game. So it's big, and obviously teams here are always looking for ways to do new things to make a bit of money, and potential of maybe having games, more competitive games with North American sides, Mexican sides, United States is something on the agenda as well. But yeah, perhaps earlier kickoff times to allow a European audience to watch the Libertadores might be something to look at, I think, more likely at the moment.
Yeah, well, this is it. Again, I was talking to Rob about this, and something that Tim Vickery keeps saying on the podcast, Radio 5 Live, in the sense that the South Americans missed the boat in terms of marketing their product and brand to Asia. Had they have done that before the UK, then they'd probably be more, well, better financially positioned.
Yeah, I think in particular Brazil. Brazil is mad. You know, they have these state championships that no one cares about playing against. You know, St. Albans City against Arsenal in a league format, for example. It doesn't make any sense, but it's tradition. That's what happens. And yeah, I think Brazil in particular is missing a big opportunity. Argentina tends to try to use football, mixes football with politics and all kinds of stuff. But I think Argentina has a great attendances, which is always consistently really good. And I think that's an important aspect of it as well. Perhaps Brazil has more depth and quality in the league. But I think the atmosphere in the Argentine stadiums probably helps to create a really interesting product, even if the football isn't always incredibly good on the field. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the Libertadores is interesting because there's no easy games. You know, it's different to the Champions League where the best team wins the game, you know. You go away to Bolivia at extreme altitude, and you turn up at the airport, and your bus driver takes a 3-hour detour to wind you up, and you get to your hotel, and there's fireworks being shot at the windows, and then you arrive at the stadium and the hot water doesn't work, and the aircon's turned off. You know, all of the tricks in the book. There's no easy games, and you get into the stadium, and the fans are right on top of you, and the team is going to do absolutely anything they can possibly do to upset you. It's very different to arriving at that Genk and playing on a perfect pitch in front of in a perfect atmosphere, and then the best team will win. But Bolivian sides have a budget the fraction of the substitute on the Brazilian sides, and they'll beat them. So it's always interesting, even if it's not great sportsmanship or purest form of the game. It's never easy, basically.
Sounds like it. Well, Simon, mate, thank you very much for jumping on the show. I really appreciate it. That was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Before I let you go, is there anything you'd like to plug or mention?
Yeah, so follow me on Twitter at Simon Edwards SAF. And as I mentioned, we've been doing these weekly episodes on some of the great moments with Tim Vickery. We actually looked at a whole episode in the 94 Colombia team. We looked at the incident with the Chilean goalkeeper where he had a flare thrown near him and then cut himself open with a stone to try and get the Brazilians kicked out of the tournament, and also the Ecuador when they went to their first World Cup. It's been really fun. So yeah, just follow me on Twitter and I can point you in the direction of some of that good stuff.
Fantastic. Right, guys, those of you still listening, give us a follow on Twitter at Shoot the Defence. We are also on Instagram. I'm posting a lot of retro stuff from the old Shoot and Match magazines that I've found in the loft somewhere. So, keeping people entertained. There you go. So, that's it, guys. So, until next time, which is probably tomorrow, take care.